In the last lecture, we examined the lifestyles and life cycle of the poor and obscure, the ordinary people. In the course of that examination, I hope that you noticed two things. First, that life in early modern England was fragile and tenuous. It was lived very much on the margins of subsistence and in the shadow of unexpected sudden death from famine, disease, and accident. The second thing I hope you noticed is that ordinary people couldn't go it alone. That to make it through life, they depended on each other and on their community. This lecture examines those institutions, habits, and attitudes of English life, which were intended to provide meaning in the face of life's tragedies and community in a cold world. These included popular religion, paternalism, extended family ties, and the support of one's neighbors. We begin with some questions. We've seen that English men and women were divided by region, class, and gender, and that their relationships to each other could be broken very easily by death and desertion. But what institutions in English life bridged these gaps and made sense of these tragedies? What coping mechanisms and support systems were available to help them to get through life? I suppose that the most important one, certainly the most obvious, was religion. Religion was intended to be the first bulwark imparting meaning and preserving order and knitting community together. In an age where average life expectancy was less than 40 years, when death could come suddenly and for no apparent reason, before modern medicine and science, religion provided one's lone explanation and much consolation for life's tribulations and surprises. Indeed, remember that this isn't just a society without science and technology. It also lacks a democratic civic consciousness and a large police force. So religion was also the principal source of worldview and structure and the standard against which justice was measured. Religion provided a theory of cosmic and social order, the great chain of being, warning against social strife. Religion explained misfortune and provided consolation and hope. Religion provided a code of moral conduct and a system of eternal rewards and punishments. After the Reformation, religion, the Protestant religion in particular, also helped to define the English as a chosen nation, engaged in an epic struggle against the Popish Antichrist. That is, English Protestantism begat English nationalism. Well, English men and women learned all this primarily by going to church. Every English subject was required to go to church according to the Acts of Uniformity beginning in 1549 and culminating in that of 1559. The church itself was arranged hierarchically. The most preeminent families sat in boxes near the front. Their ancestors were buried in the floor. Their achievements were memorialized on the walls. Everyone else sat in the order of their status. The most humble members of the parish, our woman from Lecture 20, sitting in the back. Thus, in the late 17th century, Richard Guth could actually organize his history of the village of Middle by writing it according to the pews. In short, the social order was linked directly and manifested physically to the divine order. At church, everyone was required to pray for the monarch and members of the royal family. Loyalty was further encouraged in sermons celebrating the great chain of being and warning of the consequences of breaking it. Church holidays and festivals provided relief from the daily grind. Church ceremonies, as we've indicated several times, provided important rites of passage in each life, baptism at birth, confirmation upon reaching adulthood, matrimony, the churching and of women and the baptism of their infants at birth, and, of course, Christian burial at one's death. So the parish community provided the cast of characters for some of one's most important memories. It is thus not a little ironic that religion divided and perplexed those communities as much as it united them at the end of the 16th century. You'll remember that die-hard Catholic recusants stayed away entirely, becoming objects of suspected disloyalty. In fact, they formed their own little communities apart from the main community, and that sense of being a group apart for Catholics in England lasts right the way through to modern times. Anyone who's ever read Brideshead Revisited will remember that. Would-be Puritan reformers went to the Church of England, but objected to many of its practices. For example, they didn't like the idea of churching women. I should explain now what that is. This is a ritualistic thanksgiving upon successful completion of childbirth. The woman hasn't been able to go to church while she's been laying in, and so she's brought to the church door and blessed, and re-accept it into the community. Modern feminist historians have sometimes argued that this is a sign of this society's hostility to women. You know, you're somehow out of bounds until you've been churched. But in fact, it's very clear that contemporaries didn't see it that way, that women in particular enjoyed the ceremony. They were queen for a day. Puritans didn't like any of this. They didn't like the throwing of grain at a wedding. We would throw rice. So in that sense, Puritan attitudes are the same ones embraced, I suppose, by modern insurance companies. They didn't like the clergyman's greeting at the church door of a funeral, also a sign of community. And as we shall see, they hated Christmas celebrations. These big events would be stressful at any time in life. Can you imagine the level of tension around such an occasion when an individual Puritan conscience clashes with local tradition? But everybody does it this way. Why do you have to be different? Or the convictions of the clergyman, or the official rules of the church. Imagine you're the clergyman and you're about to perform baptism on a child, and this particular local Puritan says, "Oh, I don't want no sign of the cross." And you know that if you don't do the sign of the cross, the local bishop is going to be on your back. So here, something that's supposed to emphasize community actually only emphasizes division. Puritans also objected to the fact that, despite successive acts of uniformity, church attendance was often pretty poor. All sorts of people neglected Sunday services for all sorts of excuses. I don't have suitable clothes. I feel unwelcome because I'm suspected of carrying plague. Plague carriers were banned at the church door. Perhaps one had been excommunicated for some offense or other. Some argued, as did Elizabeth Jones in 1583, that they could serve the Lord in the fields as well as in church. I think that's an argument with which we're all familiar. Others simply preferred the pleasures of the alehouse, gambling, Morris dancing, bear baiting, hunting, archery or stool ball, primitive football or soccer. Thus the great Puritan divine Richard Baxter remembered his boyhood in Shropshire. In the village where I lived, the reader read the common prayer briefly, and the rest of the day, even till dark night almost, except eating time, was spent in dancing under a maypole and a great tree not far from my father's door, where all the town did meet together, so that we could not read the scripture in our family without great disturbance of the tabor, drum, and pipe and noise in the street. When I heard them call my father Puritan, it did much to cure me and alienate me from them, for I considered that my father's exercise of reading the scripture was better than theirs. Yeah, but they were having more fun. Indeed, how one kept Sunday was a real sign of where you fit in this cultural split between Puritans and everybody else. Puritans often mounted campaigns to regulate such activity. But proponents of stool ball and good ale had their champion. It turned out that in 1618, King James I issues the Book of Sports, which, of course, advocates attendance at church, but then enumerated all of what he considered to be the perfectly acceptable country activities that one could participate in on a Sunday. As we'll see, that sort of paternal permissiveness on the part of the Stuarts was one of the things that really bothered Puritans. It divided them both from their fellow parishioners, but also from the Stuart monarchy. When people did attend church, they often, nevertheless, remained ignorant, oblivious, or even disruptive of what went on there. One clergyman complained that some sleep from beginning to end, as if the Sabbath were made only to recover the sleep that they have lost in the week. These were the docile ones, in fact. According to presentments to ecclesiastical courts, examined by the historian Keith Thomas, congregants often fought over seating, they spat, they knit, they told jokes, they even fired guns in church. In Dorchester in the 1630s, church officials complained of Henry Green, who was charged with laughing and talking and walking up and down during services. This is perhaps not as bad as the behavior of teenage boys who exchanged physical blows or morning greetings of "lousy rogue," "lousy bastard," during sermons. Sermons, their length and entertainment value have always, I suppose, been an issue for avid congregants. Bishop Gardiner complained of a 16th century parish that, "When the vicar goeth into the pulpit to read that himself hath written, then the multitude of the parish goeth straight out of the church, home to drink." Those who stayed remind Keith Thomas of nothing so much as a tiresome class of schoolboys. When the rector at Holland Magna, Essex, preached about Adam and Eve clothing themselves in fig leaves, somebody raised their hand and wanted to know where they got the thread. When the priest at Much Do Church, and let me reassure you that I do not make these names up, Herefordshire quoted church fathers in the original language. One auditor commented that he would rather hear a horse fart than the vicar preach in Latin. Now that kind of irreverence, and can we agree that this is irreverence, often manifested itself in alehouse parodies of the Eucharist or mock baptisms of dogs, cats, sheep, and horses. These are actually hard for historians to figure out. We're not actually quite sure if people were doing this to make fun of baptism or if they really did want to baptize their horse into the one true faith. All of this may help to explain why the general level of theological knowledge among the populace was always notoriously low. Both before and after the Reformation, clergy complained that many, in some parishes, most people couldn't recite the Our Father, let alone the Paternoster, or the Ten Commandments. Even those who attended the sermon reverently may not have done so knowingly. Take the example of a man of 60, a veteran of thousands of sermons, who on his deathbed, quote, being demanded what he thought of God, he answers that he is a good old man. And what of Christ? That he was a towardly youth. And of his soul? That it is a great bone in his body. And what should become of his soul after he was dead? That if he had done well, he should be put into a pleasant green meadow. So, it may have been an age of faith, but please don't assume that it was an age of informed faith. If all this were not enough to discourage a clergyman, successive Reformation and Counter-Reformation purges had reduced the active priesthood to about 8,000, which was fine, except that there were 9,000 parishes in England at this time, most of which remained very poor. This led to continued absenteeism, pluralism, and clerical poverty. There was an increasing sense of overwork and frustration on the part of the Anglican clergy. By the way, another reason for this is that landowners would often take the tithes themselves. This was known as impropriating tithes. So here's the poor priest doing his best to make a living out of this parish, probably having to farm what's called glebe land attached to the church. And it's never the best land in the village. It's the land the church is built on. And the landlord is taking the donations of the congregation. This could only have made clashes with Puritans acrimonious. You know, you put up with all of this as the clergyman, and you've got to deal with some guy who doesn't want the sign of the cross. Clashes with unruly parishioners must have been most depressing. Above all, Protestant religion may have been of less assistance to ordinary people than its predecessor, for it de-emphasized the sacraments, exorcism, and prayers to saints. These were all remedies against the power of Satan and the power of disease. Remember that before the Reformation, if you, your child, or your cow were ill, if you went on a long trip, if a storm was brewing, you called on a particular saint, a charm, a medal, or an amulet for preservation. Now, of course, the church would argue that preservation was never automatic, that these saints don't necessarily get what you want from God in every case. But I think it's fair to say that people who believe strongly in the intercession of saints can sometimes feel that they have a sort of an in this way. According to Reginald Scott, writing in the 16th century, St. Roque was good at the plague, St. Petronil at the ague. As for St. Margaret, she passed Lucina for a midwife. For madmen, which are possessed with devils, St. Roman was excellent, and Friar Ruffin was also pretty skillful in that art. For botches and biles, Cosmas and Damien, St. Clare for the eyes, St. Apolline for the teeth, St. Job for the pox, and for sore breasts, St. Agatha. According to John Aubrey, writing as late as the 17th century, the shepherds of St. Oswaldston prayed, logically, to St. Oswald to protect their sheep. But they also prayed to St. Osyth to preserve them from fire and water and all misadventure, and when they baked bread, to God and St. Stephen to send them a just batch and even. Now, it's easy to scoff at this, and undoubtedly there was plenty of errant superstition mixed in with the simple faith. But the point is surely that in a world of such danger and uncertainty, where life was short and tenuous, without any recourse to the wonders of modern science, medicine, and technology, such remedies may not have provided cure, but they sure provided comfort and psychological reassurance, and maybe even a degree of consolation. The Reformation sought to wipe all that away. At best, these practices were superstitious. Worst, they were papist. Worst of all, they were the work of the devil. In fact, though much of the paraphernalia of saints and blessings and special prayers was banished from the churches, many people found that they didn't want to give them up. Because, of course, what the Reformation is saying is, no, don't do any of that, just pray. and pray directly to God, and that'll be enough. And that wasn't enough for people trying to get through life. This helps to explain continued popular belief in witches, we'll talk about them below, fairies and ghosts. It also helps to explain why this society needed other forms of adhesive to maintain community. I'm not going to switch from religion to paternalism, deference, kinship, and neighborliness. You see, England in 1603 was not a welfare state. When religion failed, there were no public social service agencies to turn to apart from the poor law. Instead, the people of early modern England turned to each other. In theory, early modern Englishmen and women could fall back on paternalism and deference, the grease which was supposed to lubricate and thus maintain the links in the great chain of being. As we've seen, the ruling elite was taught that it owed paternal care and protection to those whom God had placed them over. In return, the ruled were taught that they owed their rulers deference, loyalty, obedience, and respect. In the words of the Book of Common Prayer, to order myself lowly and reverently to all my betters. But there is evidence that paternalism was dying as the Tudors were. There are lots of reasons for this. Remember that the Tudors had broken up the old affinities. That was a place where paternalism and deference had been exercised. Don't forget that the economic situation in this period is encouraging a more capitalistic, read, ruthless exploitation of lands, rents, and workers by landowners. Don't forget that Protestant theology has de-emphasized good works. And that members of the ruling elite were withdrawing from the communities they ruled by. It's awfully hard to be a nice paternalistic landlord if you're hiding behind your high walls and your gates, or you're living in London half the year. Maybe you're not there for the Christmas feast. Some modern historians, led by E.P. Thompson, have gone further to argue that upper-class paternalism was merely, the whole thing was a lie. It was a screen for the greed of the elite 2%. That after exploiting the masses to gain their wealth, the occasional Christmas feast was mere tokenism. In Thompson's view, the English ruling elite were mere banditti, draining the land and their tenants of wealth and energy to supply their inordinate wants. At the same time, these historians have argued that the lower 98% may have been equally dishonest, feigning respect, you know, tipping the cap, pretending to respect their betters, but in reality resenting the inequalities of their society, as in the case of a Norfolk parish clerk who, in the wake of Kett's rebellion, supposedly said, "There are too many gentlemen in England by 500. In my view, Thompson has a point, but it may be a little unfair. It may be judging the past by the standards of our own time. I basically think he's right, but I want to qualify this. The upper classes were out for themselves. We've seen that in many cases, land was more important to them than their own religious belief, remember the dissolution of the monasteries, and their own individual family members. But I suspect that, like so many of us who give a few token dollars or pounds to charity, these people did genuinely believe that they were doing some good for their fellow men and women when they endowed a school or hosted a Christmas feast or gave judgment as a JP. As indeed, I think I would like to argue that they were. Some may very well have been trying, at least subconsciously, to buy off their tenants or to assuage a God who seems to give very little scriptural encouragement to the wealthy. But I think the ultimate truth is that most of these people had so poor an understanding of the general economic and social situation that they had no idea that the problems they were attempting to solve were very largely of their own making and far too vast to be fixed by a few well-placed bequests or a Christmas pudding. For their part, the English peasantry was increasingly adept at using the idea of paternalism, saying, "You owe us," at turning that deference on and off to win concessions from their betters. We're going to see this in the next lecture. But for the really important stuff, they knew that they could only depend on family and friends, and mostly, as I'm going to argue, friends. You see, kinship was not really very strong in early modern England. By kinship, I mean your relationships to family beyond the nuclear family, which I've argued was strong. Your relationships to grandparents, to aunts, uncles, cousins. The reason for that is easy. There weren't very many of them. Most people didn't have living grandparents, for example. And remember that because of the migration, a lot of your cousins would have gone somewhere else. You would not have had contact with them. On the other hand, there were situations in which you could call an extended kin. Let's say that you were migrating yourself and you were heading off to the big city or even to America. If you had a relative there, any relative, no matter how distant, my mother's husband's, you know, my mother's husband would be a fairly close relative, but somebody fairly far away on the family tree, you could still call them cousin. The word cousin applied to virtually anyone who shared the least drop of blood with you, and you could ask for a favor, maybe some financial help to start you off. But that was about it. Most people in the village relied on an informal network of neighbors. There were, of course, no guidebooks on how to be a good neighbor. Neighborliness was a set of attitudes, shared but unspoken, which dictated certain behaviors that helped people to get along with each other and to get through life. We've already seen how neighbors came together to assist each other in moments of crisis, like birth and death. In between, they could call on neighbors to lend money or tools. There were no banks. Or to watch a house if they had to be away for an extended period. In other words, people relied on their neighbors to do for them what we rely on institutions for: banks, hospitals, mortuaries, rental agencies, insurance companies. But neighborliness wasn't just about helping each other. It was also a force for social control. It was a way of keeping people of the same rank in line, a way of forcing them to maintain traditions, the peace, and the economic viability of the community in hard times. Remember, one manifestation of neighborliness is, we're going to poke our nose in the business of your marriage. We're going to make sure you don't marry someone who's going to leave you poor and maybe leave an illegitimate child on the poor law that we're all going to have to pay for. So there was this involvement in other people's lives, a very important part of neighborliness. A good neighbor was never, or rarely, loud, drunk, blasphemous, litigious, quarrelsome, abusive, violent, sexually incontinent, a gossip, or a scold. Violate these norms and you could be subject to ostracism, which in this society could be fatal. There were different ways of forcing people to toe the line. There were different ways of letting them know that they had violated the norms of the community. One way was to write little squibs, write graffiti on their doors. I'll give you one example apparently involving a woman who had perhaps been too free in displaying various parts of her body. "Oh, hark a while, and you shall know, of a filthy beast did her breach show, and of her doing, and how undeed, in this her filth she did proceed, and went and laid upon the ground, and tucked her coats, petticoats, about her round, and because she is so brave and fine, she tucked up her heels and said she would show moonshine." There was rough music. People would gather underneath your windows and bang pots and pans. This is known as a charivari if you had violated some local norm. You might be rowed out of town on a rail. This is called a skimmington. You might be rowed out in effigy. If they were really serious about you, you'd be rowed out quite literally. Much of this was reserved for sexual behavior. Cheating, overbearing, or abusive wives, cuckolded, henpecked, or abusive husbands were often treated to charivaries and squibs. This is a way for the community to say, you have violated our sexual norms, conform, or else. Only when public ridicule failed would neighbors turn to the courts, ecclesiastical, civil, or criminal. You didn't take the law lightly. That's part of being a... going to law lightly. That's part of being a good neighbor. You didn't just sue at the drop of a hat. A reputed scold might be brought to the JP. That was legal, but she was more likely to be dunked in the river. Property disputes and minor punch-ups might be taken to the borough or manor court, but first you might go to the local clergyman. Only a notorious blasphemer or adulterer might be brought before a church court. If found guilty, he might be forced to do public penance, perhaps wearing a white robe, the color of penance, and standing with a lighted taper in the market square. Note the meeting of commerce and religion. Perhaps he might be forced to process in this garb from the square to the church. In either case, the idea was public shame. You have violated the norms of the community. The community will now heap abuse upon you. The greatest penalty which could be inflicted on a person in the early modern English village, which could be inflicted by the local authorities anyway, was probably excommunication. And excommunication means it isn't simply that you can't receive communion anymore. It isn't simply that you can't come to church anymore. you are thrown out of the community. You're no longer a part of our community. Don't bother to try to borrow a rake. Don't bother to come to church. Don't ask us to watch your house. We won't do it. But generally, good neighbors work things out. Put another way, neighborliness, not the courts, not religion, not paternalism or deference, was the first line of defense against disorder. Take the most dramatic breakdown of order in the early modern village, which I would argue was witchcraft. You might think that witchcraft was a religious crime. In fact, it was much more often a breakdown of neighborliness. Of all the things we think we know about early modern England, witchcraft may be the one most hedged about with legends, myths, stuff, and nonsense. First, contrary to popular belief, a phrase which by now you figured I do dearly love, witchcraft accusations were extremely rare in medieval England. In fact, it only became a crime in 1542. The only time in England that there were really witch scares and massive prosecutions was the 1590s and the 1630s, 40s. Now, pay attention to those dates. You already know some of the significance of the 1590s, terrible famines. Second, witches were never burnt at the stake in England, nor in Salem. The penalty was hanging. Third, there was never a tradition in England that witches gathered in covens. Rather, the typical English witch was very much like our old woman from Lecture 20. She was old, she was single, she was living alone, usually on the margins of poverty. Now, that profile and the fact that witchcraft hit it big between 1580 and 1640 has suggested all sorts of interpretations to historians. One group thought for a while that it had to do with the Puritans. But if you look carefully at the Puritans and what they write about the devil and witches, they don't really fear them any more than other Christians did. There's nothing there. There's nothing specific there. A more recent interpretation is that witchcraft prosecutions were aimed at suppressing women. After all the witches are women and all the judges are men. The problem with this interpretation is that most of the accusers turn out to be women as well. So this has led to a qualification of the feminist interpretation. It is that this is a society which forces women to compete with each other. One way to get an experienced, perhaps sexually experienced, woman out of the way was to accuse her of being a witch. But why go after poor, older women? Keith Thomas has suggested another more nuanced interpretation, which places witchcraft in the context of the Reformation and socioeconomic trends that we've been discussing, as well as neighborliness. He examined scores of witchcraft cases, and he noted a certain pattern. Let's assume that we're following our little old woman through the village. One of the things Keith Thomas noticed is that accused and accusers almost always knew each other, and what happened always went something like this. Our little old woman in the 1590s is short of food. She knocks on one of her more prosperous neighbor's door. Now, remember that after the Reformation, there's much less pressure on that neighbor to actually give her some food because good works don't get you into heaven. Remember, the times are hard, which is one reason that she's going in the 1590s from door to door. They probably refuse her. As they refuse her, she wanders off. And as she wanders off, she mutters something under her breath. It might be a curse. She might be talking about the weather. She might be delirious. Within days, or weeks, or months, or years, somebody dies. Because in England, somebody is always dying. Now remember that since the Reformation, we don't really have saints to rely on to help us to deal with these tragedies. We have to explain it. And the easiest explanation is, it was that old woman muttering under her breath. The sense of powerlessness and perhaps guilt at denial of charity combined with an economy that was making lots of women poor may explain the rise in witchcraft accusations at the end of the 16th century. Thomas's interpretation is still being debated by historians, but what I like about it is that it ties together so many of the themes of this lecture. The power and importance of religious belief to explain the unexplainable, the precarious place of women in the local community, the narrowness and cruelty of which the early modern village was capable. Ultimately, in Thomas's interpretation, a witchcraft accusation is a failure to be neighborly. All of which suggests that if neighborliness was the first line of defense against disorder, it was a pretty fragile and porous line. This raises a number of questions about the village community. What if disagreements couldn't be worked out? What if religion failed to instill conventional morality or good behavior? What happened when ordinary people refused to show deference or respect kin, or above all, get along with their neighbors? In this lecture, we examine how the world of Elizabethan and Jacobean English men and women was supposed to work. In the next lecture, we'll examine what happened when religion, deference, kinship, and neighborliness, and thus the community itself, broke down.